nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and guests and are not necessarily those of the Information Radio Network, its affiliates, stations, or advertisers.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of our good friend Bill Sardi. And we're going to be talking about, of all things, what's happening financially. Well, of course, as you know, today was a very dramatic day on the stock market. When I got up this morning, first thing, about 6:30 Pacific Coast time, the market was down over 600 points. By the time I got on the radio, about 7 o'clock, the market was down 100 points. Apparently, it got ahead over 300 points, and then it closed down 180 points, 120, 128, 20 points today. It was simply writhing all over the field, just like a dying snake. And, of course, we've seen dramatic decrease in the stock market here over the last week to 10 days. And, of course, the market's closing down below 8,000. Oh, this is simply a manifestation of the fact that our economy is in trouble. People are having difficulty borrowing money. Corporations are having difficulty borrowing money. Government agencies are having difficulty borrowing money. The whole financial system is contracting. And, of course, we have two political candidates who neither one of them will address the real issue. And the real issue is the fact that we have a fiat money system. We've created countless trillions of dollars with nothing, absolutely nothing behind it. We've exported our inflation throughout the world. There is no asset-backed monetary system in the world today. And, of course, the whole system is simply imploding and seems to be on a one direction down towards destruction. And what have we done? Why, we've, of course, gotten hold of the very people who created the problem and given them $850 billion, that's almost $1 trillion, to try to correct the problem that they've created, actually to bail out the friends on Wall Street. And if you believe that anything that's happening is going to help the average individual, you're mistaken. And the first $850 billion is simply the first down payment on the installment of trillions more that are going to be poured out that are eventually going to lead to the destruction of the value of our currency. So with that as a background, let's go to our good friend Bill Sardi. Hi, Bill. How are you doing?
How do I explain this to my 4-year-old boy who wants to know why Daddy's going to do the radio show tonight?
Right.
And I said, well, I'm going to explain why people don't have any money. He said, why don't they have any money? I said, well, now I paused. How do I explain it to a 4-year-old? I said, well, because somebody robbed them of all their money. So my 4-year-old wanted to know if I was going to tell everybody about the robbers. I don't know of any other better way to say it. They're robbers, or as some people are calling them, the banksters. So I don't know how we shift all the losses to the public and all the gains they take privately. I don't know how that system goes, but that's what we've invented, socialistic losses and privatized profits. So this is kind of what we have today. And, they have this... $700 and some billion, not one bit of it went to the public. It all went to bail out the banks. Not going to help one person with a foreclosure. And now they've got this HOPE program. And if your mortgage is more than 31% of your income, they're going to come help you out. You know how many people are going to invent the crisis so that you're going to make the housing market collapse We'll explain it when we get back. But
all right, fine. I think the point is so well made that, of course, they want to focus our attention on the CEOs and their large salaries and golden parachutes. They want to focus our attention on the party that the people from AIG held some $400,000 for 10 people while we were picking up the tabs. But, ladies and gentlemen, they're focusing our attention on the wrong issues intentionally. Well, Bill, you go ahead and pick up the story.
Well, you know, they're going to do this little hope program here, and as you read through it, they're trying to fix the housing market, and yet some people predict it's going to harm the housing market. And, you know, as they're saying, trigger the law of unintended consequences, as now you're going to have people kind of trying to get into mortgage default so they qualify for the program. Yeah, we all know about these kinds of things. So when your income is not enough to pay, then they look and see if it's more than 31% of your mortgage payment is of your income, then you're going to qualify for this program. So you're going to have all kinds of people go into default and not pay for three quarters or four quarters in a row to try and get into this program, because then they're going to be given some sort of special, terms and so on. I was reading here what IndyMac is doing, and I think I sent it to you earlier in the week. And IndyMac was the first bank to be acquired, really, by the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, put out of business. They can't find a buyer for IndyMac yet. And we were reading, well, exactly what IndyMac is trying to do to get prepped up to be sold. And they have 742,000 loans in their portfolio as a bank, which I found was really quite large for a relatively new bank. And they're renegotiating these mortgages with homeowners. And when their income, they're trying to get the mortgage payment monthly not to be greater than 38% of their gross income. Wow. 38% of their gross income. It used to be, what was it at one time? 20-25%, Dr. Stan, I believe, is what your house payment should have been. So now they're up here at 38%. But if you take somebody who, either through one or two income family, makes $60,000 a year, their federal income tax is going to be 25%, their state income tax 9.3%. And what this comes out to be is this, the mortgage payment is close to $24,000, the federal income tax is another $15,000, you've got another $5,000 or $6,000 on with the state tax, you've got property tax of another $3,000, and what do you end up with? About, well, less than $1,000 a month to live off of. When they're finished with all the taxes and the mortgage payment, this is what they're negotiating out of these people. So your car payments, your health insurance, your food, everything from your whatever else you have there, clothing and what all, is less than $1,000 a month to live off.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris Bill is simply talking about the absurdity of what they're doing, and they're just talking about how they're going to bail these people out, their house payments are 31 or 38%. Well, I forgot the exact figure, but anyway, of their income. And basically, of course, they're going to end up with people who are going to have, just simply nothing to live on by the time they get through paying everything else. Believe me, ladies and gentlemen, there's no problem facing America today that a new government program won't make worse. So you go right ahead, Bill.
Well, and, this is a five-year program. So the HOPE program goes on for 5 years. You get to stay in the house you're in, and then 5 years from now, it all reverts back to the same crisis again. So about a third of the IndyMax delinquent foreclosed, the people have no income whatsoever to even qualify for the HOPE program. They're just lost. The other two-thirds, they're going to put them under this very strict program. Of course, we don't know how much they have on their credit cards and other things. So it really makes for a difficult time, and I just can't see this working too long. And then we're now left with the, do I owe myself the mortgage if the government comes in and starts buying a part interest in the banks, then that's me. Isn't that me, the taxpayer that owns that? So I'm a little confused here. So one would think they said the government's going to buy up a certain amount of mortgages, bad mortgages, and then they're leading us to believe that would be a good deal because we could sell them off at some time. People are led to believe when you buy something from the government, maybe as an auctioned item or maybe in bulk, 100 homes at a time, that you're going to get a great deal on it. So the public, the taxpayer, is going to take a hit on this. Nobody's going to be expected to pay a top dollar again for these homes at the old overinflated prices. So there's no way we're going to make more than the value they've been at. So the government can only lose if they acquire all these properties. And who will manage them? Is there an organization in the federal government that knows how to organize and manage a bunch of houses with brown lawns? I'm lost. I don't know where that branch of government is. So it gets a little confusing what they're talking about, except to shift the losses away from the banks. Now, if you're talking about frozen money, this is what they were talking about. The money's all frozen up, and they were, of course, going to lower the interest rate from the Federal Reserve. So you all that are listening and catch up with this, the Federal Reserve divvies out the money supply in the country, and, of course, they drop their rate, which is the rate of interest they charge other banks. They're the main bank that distributes money. And, of course, they're going to drop that rate a little bit, which is half of 1%, I believe. But that doesn't do any good because the banks don't trust each other. They know what dire straits they're all in. None of them have any of your money left in the bank that you deposited there in a savings account. There is no money there. Now, what they do have is reserves required by law, but those reserves have had to be loaned from the Federal Reserve. So they're in real deep trouble, the banks, and they have none of your money. And the banks don't trust each other because they know they're kind of fibbing on like how many bad loans they have on this mortgage home loan problem. Some of the banks not reporting, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the major quasi-government home loan organizations, have tens of thousands of homes that they didn't put on the rolls as being totally foreclosed home loans, just hiding them off the books. We don't know how many more tens of thousands there are on these other banks' books. So the banks don't trust each other, and that's why they're not freeing it up. And the money is needed to go between banks because not everybody loans from the Fed. The smaller banks loan from other banks. And then this is how you get money eventually to a building project. Construction trade going, and that's all frozen up these days as people in construction can't finish their projects because the banks don't have the money to make the next advance payment. So this is what's going on, and I don't think the rate cut meant a thing. These are all meaningless. And Dr. Stan, didn't we get into this trouble because we had cheap money? I mean, it would be nice to think all of us as consumers that we could, loan money at a cheap interest rate, but it got so cheap that it was so easy for people to get into, and this is our problem. We came in, let's allow by mandate that a number of people that have low incomes have a right to have a home, and then when we default on it, we'll just push those onto the rich or the other people. And so this is kind of what happened. The government forced this mandate. By the way, the city I live in is Laverne, California, and in Laverne, they have a number of trailer parks here, and therefore that meets all the federal requirements for having low-income housing, and they haven't had to build, by mandate from the federal government, any new housing. But if they didn't have these trailer parks here, if the owners decided to gut them and change them around, the city would be in terrible trouble, as by mandate you're supposed to have so much low-income housing in your neighborhood. And this is, of course, what has goofed the whole thing up. They mandated the cities had to have low-income housing, then went around the other side and of course, made it so that people that never should own a home, never were in a financial situation to do that, had the liar's loans where they didn't have to really show that what their income really was, and then gave them a low rate of interest, which was going to be increased later on, the so-called adjustable rates, and, of course, gave them no down payment. And in some cases, some people had $25,000 tacked onto their loan and then gave them $25,000 cash. And this is where people went out and bought a new car and did all those things as kind of a bonus, not realizing what they were getting into. And then as the speculative value of their home went up, they went out and got a second mortgage and got more money that they loaned and lived off it like a piggy bank. And then when all that ran out, well, that's where we are today. These people are on the front page of the newspapers claiming they had their home taken away from them. What home? They never put a dollar down, and they bilked all the rest of the money out of the thing, and now we're trying to, what? Shove that debt onto you, you who's listening tonight. So where's the outrage? It's unbelievable. $700 billion was just to take the minus signs off the bank's accounts. It had nothing to do with recapitalizing our country. There's no money to make a car loan or a home loan today. The banks are just trying to take care of their debts, which is all they're doing. And so there's no extra money left in the bank to loan. It's hard for you to get a loan today. So they didn't fix this problem. They made it worse. And this is why so many people who we were novices were simply saying, just let it fall. Just let it collapse. And we'll just let it get fixed from there. And, of course, we now have some surveys here. There was one this week. 56% of Americans say they've been harmed by the financial crisis. The harm is coming when we see the unemployment rates go way up. They're going to hide that at first. Then there'll be no hiding it. And really, right now, we just have some dollar signs, just some paper money that people lost. And it's their fortunes, it's their pensions, it's their future. All of that dashed, all their savings gone. But now what we're looming on is that the economy slows down, small business fails, and we have massive unemployment. You remember in the Depression years, 1930s, the unemployment rate was said to be 30%. I don't know how high it's going to get here. This is supposed to be a worse crisis than in those days. I don't think we're going to have people in food lines. I don't know. I know the food bank here that we give food to used to support 25 families. It now has 75 families to feed every week. And every time we go there, the food shelves are barren at this point. So I don't know how far this is going to go. I do know that people are living in cars, living under bridges and park their car and that kind of thing. It's a better situation than what we had during the Depression, but nonetheless, it's not one that's becoming of, well, the most advanced country in the world. And yet this is what we're down to.
Well, of course, there are some tent cities that are springing up in Southern California and North California. People have just been evicted from their homes. People don't seem to understand that they are creating trillions of dollars out of nothing. The $850 billion that they borrowed just a week ago today, or that they appropriated a week ago today, where is the money coming from? Because the United States Treasury doesn't have any money. They're having to borrow a couple of billion dollars, $2.5 billion a day just to pay their bills. Where did the money come from? Well, that's just to actually increase the national debt, $850 billion in one day. That's almost $1 trillion. People have forgotten that it took 200 years for the United States to amass a national debt of $1 trillion. 200 years from 1789 until 1979, 1980. And then the debt was $1 trillion. And, of course, now we are increasing the national debt $1 trillion every 15 months under George Bush. But not to be outdone, in one day, a week ago today, they increased the national debt $850 billion, almost $1 trillion. And believe me, this is just the down payment on this whole situation. The Treasury and the Federal Reserve gave the central banks over in Europe about $1 trillion to $1.5 trillion to try to get their systems working. They put out $0.75 trillion to $1 trillion here in the United States. I mean, they bought AIG for $85 billion. They're going to have to give it an additional $36 billion, and that doesn't even account the $400,000 weekend the executives had on our because of our generosity. But the whole system of the world is beginning to come down. This is not just the United States. This is Europe. This is Asia. The whole world system, Arabs, coming down. We'll go right ahead, Bill.
National debt clock says, well, have you got an extra $34,000 for every U.S. citizen? This isn't every worker. This is every child.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a 4-tape or a 4-CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets, a little protects your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt. That nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away. And the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-
Oh. families, and of course the Rockefellers are one of the major forces here in the United States. We hear about J.P. Morgan Chase. Nobody ever tells you that David Rockefeller was the president of the Chase Manhattan Bank for 20 years. And of course, we find that there are a number of families, European families, that owned American banks. And of course, but this is the one thing that, of course, we've always been afraid of. We didn't want to be controlled by foreigners because they had no loyalty to America. But there are foreigners with strong holdings here within our banking system. But most people are unaware of this. Now, we talk about the Rothschilds and their influence, and certainly they have a profound influence. But what people do not understand is that the Rothschilds family is deeply involved in this whole world satanic movement. In fact, the satanic movement permeates every aspect of the banking fraternity. And if anybody doubts that, we have a little pamphlet that's put out by a Luciferian organization known as the Lucius Trust. It's called of the working of the spiritual hierarchy. They distributed this, and they said they wanted it distributed, so we're just helping them. Interestingly enough, once we started talking about it, they pulled it down off the website there at thelucistrust.org, but we'll be glad to send anybody out there a copy where they talk about how they have their people in the financial institutions all over the world. You're not going to hear that elsewhere, but that's what they say, and who am I to disagree with these people? Go right ahead, Bill.
You know, I think when audiences that are getting initiated to your program hear some of this issue of spiritual forces being involved, they don't understand that you've done a lifetime of research to link. You didn't go out searching for this. You just happened to find it, that people behind this secret world order that runs the world, we're talking about the people who run the banks and elsewhere, and they seem to be linked up to the occult, linked up to spiritual forces that are, well, anybody would call them bizarre. And why? And so, you know, when we look at this, the chart of who owns the Federal Reserve and so on, and we have the Rothschild family. Here's the greatest financial crisis the world has faced in modern times. We have the Rothschild family, the Schroeder family. We have certainly the Rockefellers. Are any of them speaking or answering questions? No. Why? Why, they would be the people the news media should be asking. And you know what? I think some of these people have a lot of hidden income. It's said that the Rothschild family owns trillions of dollars. Why, they could snap their fingers and fix this whole thing, couldn't they? Or are they have an agenda here with this collapse? And Dr. Stan has made us aware that maybe they're trying to get to one world currency. Maybe there's a reason for this collapse. Certainly is odd that it would come at the very end of one president's term so he could do his dirty work and get out. It just smells. And when we realize none of this bailout is for us, let's just give you some examples. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation said something that might have made you feel good, and that was that they increased the insurance on deposits in banks from $100,000 to $250,000. I want you all to realize they didn't do that to help you out. They did that for the banks. Let me explain. Billions of dollars was lost by depositors. The FDIC sent out press releases and said, no one has lost any money. If they didn't go over the $100,000 limit, that was the asterisk in their press releases, while billions of dollars of public money was being lost, the FDIC didn't do a thing and only has to snap its fingers. It doesn't have to go to any other agency, and it could have simply raised the insurance amount to $250,000 as it did in the last few days. It knew exactly how much money was at risk that citizens had over the $100,000 insurance mark. I think there was $42 billion just in Washington Mutual alone. So they knew all that. They didn't take any action to protect your money or send out press releases and warn everybody, you know, make sure you don't have over $100,000 in any bank because they only insure the depositor, not each account. And so, you know, they only did this after the the bank run started. The FDIC increased the limit from $100,000 to $250,000 because the banks complained that people were taking money out and putting it in another bank and they were losing deposits. Anything over $100,000 they were taking, putting in another bank. It was to save the bank. It was not to save you. I hope you think the government's working on your behalf. They aren't.
Okay, we're going to be back in just a moment with Bill Sardi, who's right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Of course, we have Steve calling in from Illinois. Steve, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, sir. I'm hoping that we don't get bogged down in minutia, but, you know, I'm going to really cut to the chase for you, Dr. Stan. I've talked to you a number of times and with your guest here. It's vitally important to record or go back and find out when these monkeys in our Congress got together and redistricted. Now, it was done a few years ago. This started with Ronald Reagan, by the way, all this getting the skids greased. And these boys got together. That was really scary, the Republicans and Democrats, so they could all hold their districts. So that should have told people a lot right there. Now, I'm going to tell you real fast here when the last curtain is going to fall. This money in this country worldwide means absolutely nothing, but it does mean something to these players, these usual suspects, going on long enough to buy up all the so-called toxic properties, because they're going to get all the land, and I don't care, they're getting everything, the same people that put us in this situation, and then they're going to collapse the monetary system for everybody else, but they will have all this land grabbed at fire sale prices or zero or whatever. I mean, for people not to be able to see this going on, as stupid as I am, and you got people coming out and explaining their thing. We need to come out of our houses like yesterday.
Okay, fine. Steve, I really appreciate your thoughts. I think that we're in real trouble, and I fear that this is going to be a means of aggrandizing the rich and impoverishing the poor, and certainly wiping out the middle class. I agree with you. But thanks so much. And do you have any comments at all upon what our guest was saying there, Bill?
Well, certainly, you know, my congressman, they gerrymandered the district so I couldn't kick him out. And then they re-gerrymandered, and now he's representing me again. I keep trying to get this guy out of office, and it's kind of impossible because they just keep moving things around. And these are favors between the two parties to keep, the incumbents in there. There's an economist here I was reading a little bit from. I'll try to identify him. It's Alfred Weber, W-E-B-R-E-J-D, obviously an attorney, and he's from Vancouver, B.C. He has a seven-step program to fix this thing, seven steps to transform the global financial crisis. He calls the crisis a financial false flag operation. And so his seven-step plan...
Hold that thought. We're going to be back in just a moment with Bill Sardi. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course our guest is Bill Sardi. And Bill Sardi was simply quoting an economist who had suggested that the current crisis is a financial false flag operation. Would you like to elaborate on that thought?
Well, false flag operations are something done up to, as we think we saw 9/11 or other things, so that it rallies the people around the flag and some sort of a crisis that's going on. And of course, his program to solve this whole thing is abolish the Federal Reserve Bank, create a central U.S. bank as a public utility. Some would argue with some of these things. Prohibition of fractional reserve banking. For all of you, that's over your head. When you deposit a dollar in the bank, they get to lend out $10 out of thin air. They just make the money out of nothing. And forgiveness of all public debt worldwide, that's what this economist suggests, and then decentralized coordination of a new economy. In other words, let people solve it through the private enterprise, or certainly not on this massive federal level. As you see now, they have a dictatorial control of our country, and then a financial war crimes tribunal. How do you like that? Now, I was talking to a man from China, runs a business here. He's fully westernized, but his company has a base in China where they get raw materials, and then they make goods here also. So he has a foot on both continents in Asia and here. And he said if anybody had done this in China, they'd be in jail today. Isn't that interesting? That lawless group of Chinese would have figured this out and certainly thrown somebody in jail. What happened to us? So, and you know, the arrogance of this whole thing, as you see the public outrage, everybody can repeat that, you know, the AIG people were ready to go off onto that little event at a ritzy hotel for $440,000. Everybody has repeated that over and over again. And it's the arrogance. They're the elites. We're the chattel. We're the peons. We're the pawns in the chess game. They really don't care about us. The FDIC didn't care that your money was at risk in a bank. Didn't make any effort to tell you this crisis was coming. And then only, well, up the amount that the insured accounts for. When the banks were losing depositors, they're all there for the banks. Nobody's there for you. So you just got to kind of understand how this thing goes. Will any of the $700 billion go to anybody who's having a home foreclosed? No. So that just goes to the bank minus science to cover all their fraud. And, of course, on and on again in this charade, the President of the United States is supposed to be the lawmaker of last resort. We don't hear anything from him as he lets the banksters literally fleece our country and shift all the debt onto your back. And, well, the burden's getting pretty heavy here. As I have said before on the air here at Dr. Stan's Radio Liberty program, if you had a young man and he was going to school and he took out loans to get through college and then he didn't make the grade and failed and did not earn a degree, and therefore he then comes up with legislation he once passed to get all the students who did pass and get a degree in college to pay for his education debts. Now, if you think that's outrageous, that's exactly what the bailout is. We can't have irresponsibility, whether it's in banking or running schools or kids or anything. And so we're rewarding irresponsibility. And as this one article says in the newspapers, now that people get a hold of this Project Hope idea, they're going to start qualifying, making sure that their homes foreclose so they get better terms on their foreclosure. You're asking for the unintended consequences as the thing gets bigger and bigger.
And I think it's so important that people understand that the $700 billion is simply a down payment. This is not going to get us out of the problem. There's going to be trillions of dollars that are going to have to be put out, and that's still not going to solve the problem, because this problem is that we have a monetary system without any foundation to it. And, of course, this is a worldwide situation, and there are literally trillions of American dollars out all throughout the world being held as reserve currencies. And when those reserve currencies begin coming home here, being used to buy up certainly our stock market, if there's any stock market left to buy up, being left to buy up the our roads and our turnpikes and our water systems and our sewage systems and our electric systems and our public utilities, eventually, of course, all that money is going to come in here. It's going to be highly inflationary. And then the price and the value of our currency is going to begin to fall and fall and fall. And very soon, why, we'll look like the Weimar Republic. We'll look like Iceland does today, where the whole system has imploded because they tried to live off of debt, and you can't do it indefinitely, especially when countries throughout the world are really beginning to hate you, hate because America's responsible for what's going on, and we cannot bail out the whole world. So go ahead, Bill.
We certainly can't bail out the whole world, and all they have to do is stop sending it to us. Japan thought of it a few years ago. They just announced to the United States one day that, out of the Japanese Diet, their Congress there, that they were thinking about maybe not reinvesting the money back into the United States, but putting it into the European Euro just thinking about putting part of the money that they make from the United States. And the very next week, North Korea shot a missile over Japan into the ocean. And, of course, that basically told the Japanese, go ahead, see who defends you. So it makes you wonder who controls North Korea and who, you know, calls the shots in the world, and certainly how these things get maneuvered around. I was very curiously interested in why Lehman Brothers, if you all weren't paying attention, why they bailed out everybody else. They found a foreign buyer or some way for Washington Mutual and Wachovia. Everybody else got bailed out but Lehman Brothers. They let that house collapse and fall. And it was very interesting. It came out that Lehman Brothers was helping Hugo Chavez in Venezuela with some credit. Ladies and gentlemen, maybe you think Hugo Chavez is the bad guy that President Bush and others in the administration have painted. He's the man who has some oil from Venezuela and offered it to our country to break OPEC's hold on our country for oil and gasoline prices and show us that oil could be a lot cheaper. And we went along with our president, who demonized Chavez, treated him like, quote, a communist, and maybe we should go down there and rub him out. And you all fell for it. Chavez then gets a little help from Lehman Brothers. We'll teach you. We'll just let you crash and fall. OPEC is an absolute thug outfit. The OPEC was started because it was a glut of oil and it was too cheap. You notice now that Americans don't have the money. They've been gouging us. Oh, now we'll drop the price of oil. And you still don't see the gasoline prices come down as far as they could. But you see, they're just taking every dollar they can get out of us, and then when we don't have it, they'll finally be a little more affordable. So, and how do the oil companies know how much money we have left for gasoline? The Department of Labor gives them all that information, how much money you make, what percentage of money goes to health insurance, to clothes, to cars, everything. So then they can learn how to gouge us and take as much as they can get. That's what our government is in league with industry in doing. And so, you know, we just got to stop this train somehow. I just don't know how we're going to get the power to do it. They control all this. Now, there's an unfortunate, I'll call it a rumor, nothing more than that. But, you know, we have a banking kind of holiday on Monday this week. We got a Saturday, Sunday. Monday is Columbus Day, so the banks are closed. There are rumors they're going to extend that banking holiday maybe to Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday, calm things down a little bit because people are pulling all their money out of the banks. Boy, that kind of rumor on a radio show like this would get more people to run down and pull money out of the bank. So I just want to say it's a rumor, but I read it in Forbes magazine. I read it in responsible places. And, you know, there's an economist from Argentina trying to tell us all, get your dollars out now. Argentina's been through this same whole thing. He thinks maybe they're going to have a banking holiday, too. Maybe they'll devalue the U.S. dollar. Maybe they'll even come out with a new currency. Maybe we don't even know what they've got up their sleeve. If that's true, boy, that would really be something.
Well, we know that they really want, at least the Council on Foreign Relations has published articles talking about a global currency which would be privately issued and, of course, would be gold-backed. And, of course, this would give stability to the financial system. We do know, of course, that the Rockefellers, and I'm sure the Rothschilds as well, have been buying up the gold that is being sold by the central banks because, after all, who in the listening audience here today has enough money to buy up 50 tons of gold, what is put on the market, or 500 tons of gold? And, of course, everything is long-range planning. They know exactly what's going to happen, but they always like to surprise us. Well, let's go to Brian, who's calling from Mount Vernon, Washington State, and, of course, he's been waiting patiently. Vernon, do you have a question for our guest?
Oh, yeah, hello?
Yeah, go right ahead.
Yeah, but the thing is that, you know, I wrote my congressman, and from what I'm seeing on the news and everything, people aren't listening to the congressman, you know, aren't heeding the people's will,
Well, I think, of course, Brian, what you have to realize is you're going to have an opportunity to vote in November, and I hope you'll remember in November that that Congressman voted in favor of the bailout for the banks and to rape the people. And I think you should tell everybody how he votes, and of course, this man should be retired, and I believe that everybody who voted in favor of the bank bailout should be retired. But right now, he may ignore you, but he's not going to ignore you in November, believe me.
Right. And so, congressmen were told that by their constituents that they were not for the bailout, but they voted for it anyway.
They did, and they tried to give their reasons. Of course, we have a republic, not a democracy. That's to stop mob rule, so then you see how they take advantage of that. They're the elites. They know better than us.
Okay, well,
it's
wait.
It's our money, though, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, the thing of it is that a lot of this stemmed from way back, where a lot of the things you had lobbying from groups like Acorn, that you know what I'm saying, and where they funded low income housing, and from that HUD and these they were mandated by Congress to loan certain percentages of all loans had to be funded to low-income housing. And so they made these loans available to people that couldn't afford them. You know what I'm saying?
And you're absolutely right. It's an excellent point. But that was how we got into the mess. But the question is, how do we get out of the mess?
Okay, well, listen. What I suggested was, okay, if you're going to do the bailout, what I suggest is that, like, if you won't listen to us and you're going to do it, then you'd have to put some sort of value on each home that you were going to, in other words, okay, let's say you have Bank A that has, let's say, 10,000 or whatever, 100,000 homes on their books. That have been foreclosed, and so the government will buy out those homes if they were going to buy them out. They're going to buy them out at that value, but they have to be valued.
But Ryan, where is the money going to come from?
Well, exactly.
We do not have any money. Our government is bankrupt, and it's a great idea, but it's not going to work. Thanks very much. But anyway, go ahead. Bill, do you have a comment on what Brian was saying?
I go along with the caller in the sense that, yeah, he's trying to make us all aware. What I am concerned about now is this class warfare. As I listen to people being interviewed on television, they interviewed a black realtor, and she just wants to go back. Where's our free houses? These people have been kind of told that, they're Americans and they have a right to a home. Now, I just don't know what to think. When the vote came for the bailout, the minorities voted hard and fast against the bailout because they knew what it was. It was to bail out the banks. It wasn't to help out little people. They knew that. But what bothers me here is that they're voting along totally class lines. They still want to rob from the rich. Ladies and gentlemen, the rich aren't going to exist there. We keep going like this. You can't bail out, for instance, the state of California by taking more money from the rich. They couldn't possibly balance the budget. And now we have an unbelievable situation. As you know, states and cities can't do what the federal government can do, which is to print money. So Schwarzenegger, the governor, wants $7 billion of the federal bailout money because he can't print it, so he wants to go get the guys that can print it and take that money. He can't handle a 5% cut in the state budget here. I'm not fingering one man. I'm fingering our whole state here. If we can't cut back our budget by 5%, any good business can when it's put through trials and tribulations. So we're going to have to... The government cannot be elite. It cannot... The people in our local area here in Laverne, California, want to pass a school bond. But the kids need it, and I'm sure they do. There's no bond money, folks. Yeah, you will eventually get the money in assessments from taxpayers over 5 years, but there's no bond money. And if there is bond money, the interest rate is going to be horrible.
Because the thing is, if Arnold Schwarzenegger could issue bonds and, of course, get the money on a temporary basis, he would. But the trouble is, the money is not available.
The money's
quickly go.
Not there. And this is where we're having a trouble. The caller was trying to help us, too, but didn't quite see. We're broke. It's a fire sale, folks. It's half off. If you can get anybody from a foreign government come in here and buy interest in our banks, buy out office buildings, buy up Anheuser-Busch, as InBev did from Belgium. It's a fire sale. It's 50% off, folks. We've got to recapitalize our country.
Let's go to Mark calling quickly from Idaho. Mark, do you have a quick question? We're almost out of time.
Yes. Good evening, gentlemen. My question is, being in the payroll side of things at work, is would it be advisable to drop any direct deposit systems like your QuickBooks, which is, I think, stationed in the Philippines, and just write checks to the employees so they can cash them at the bank? Because there could be a problem with the computerized side of things. Do you see a problem there, Bill, doing that?
Well, I do, because at least in the short term, you know, they're going to stop. They're going to be banking hang-ups and, you know, troubles. And you're going to see two-week, three-week delays. If you've got employees, well, they may not be able to handle that. And so I do see issues there. And as I've said before, try and find a bank that didn't do any of these adjustable rate mortgages or has access to foreign capital like Union Bank of California. We haven't got all the time to explain it, but, you know, that's what you need to do.
So if they just took their check down to the local bank, it'd be faster than that.
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, thanks very much.
Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, we've got Mark calling from Florence, Oregon. Mark, do you have a question for our guest?
Yeah, hi, Dr. Stanton, Bill. You know, I've been thinking about the actual overall effect of this is that larger trans...
I know what it's like to lay awake at night and worry about mounting credit card debt, that nagging feeling in the pit of your stomach that just won't go away, and the phone calls from collectors. Forget about it. Then I called Help You Out of Debt. Their professional staff of debt mediators were able to help me get my upside-down finances back on track and help stop the phone call. My Help You Out of Debt settlement specialist understood exactly what I was going through. My specialist was able to get creditors off my back, negotiate huge reductions on most of my balances, and help me fight back against the credit card companies. Help You Out of Debt specialists are experts in debt mediation and settlement. They are on your side. They've helped thousands of people just like me and can help you too. Call now and get a free debt review. If you're $10,000 or more in credit card or unsecured debt and ready to start fighting back, call 866-374-3101 and get your free debt review. That's 866-374-3101 or on the web at helpyououtofdebt.com. 866-374-3101.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
fact, you can go to our website, or basically the basic thing to do would be to Google in Brad Sherman dictatorship, military dictatorship. Brad Sherman military dictatorship. He's a congressman. You'll hear him saying that they were told that if they did not pass the emergency funding bill the last Friday, a week from today, a week ago today, that by Monday there would be military troops on the streets of our nation would be under martial law. You'll actually hear the congressman saying that the congressmen were told that was the very real possibility. If you can't find it on Google, you can go to my website, radioliberty.com. Look it under other videos, and there's a section there where we have the YouTube connection link for Brad Sherman. But anyway, Bill, we're out of time. It's always a pleasure. Really appreciate you being with us. Do you have a parting thought before we let you go?
I hope we pin the tail on the right donkey. We really have something good going in the midst of this. Don't get real nervous. Some people tell me, don't send me any more of those emails. Listen, they're taking our country away from us. Don't flinch now because, you know, the citizenry's catching on. We got our chance.
I believe you're absolutely right. I think people are going to listen now who never would have listened before. God bless, Bill. Thanks very much for being with us. And first, one of our favorite guests is Bill Sardi, a personal friend. Well, this is the time when I have to remind our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we need your help probably as much as ever before. In fact, far more than ever before, because many of our listeners really are caught in this economic squeeze, and they're having a difficult time. And if you are in a position to help us, so we can maintain our network of 60 radio outlets, over 60 radio outlets every week. I'm talking about internet, satellite, shortwave, and radio stations. Why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today. And then, of course, we would simply mention that we are having an all-day seminar on October 26th, just a little over 2 weeks from today, and it's going to be the Aptos Seascape Golf Course here on the North Shore of beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay. We're bringing in Dr. Russell Blaylock to talk about medicine, Joanna Michelson to talk about the supernatural and all the miracles that she witnessed, but, of course, they were not of the Lord. And then finally, Patrick Wood will be here. He'll be talking about financial matters. We're going to have Michael Shaw talking on the plan, the master plan for world government, which we call sustainable development, or Agenda 21, which is the agenda for the 21st century. Michael does a great job. And then, well, I'll be there as well. We're going to be serving lunch. You're going to have reservations. So if you'd like to come, and I can guarantee you're going to have a great time, our number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-5-HIV-WAR. If you've not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, or seen the video, the DVD, you need to get it, because this will explain to you the spiritual component of everything going on today. Our talk on the forbidden secret with the syllabus, our talk on the planned police state with the syllabus, our talk on sustainable development with the syllabus, our talk on Iraq, the untold story with the syllabus, and, of course, we have syllabuses on so many of the talks we've given. Information that you need to have at your fingertips to be able to understand what's going on today. Because there is an organized effort to confuse you. And once you understand that, why, so many things do begin to make sense. We have a talk called the Financial Tsunami. Comes with a syllabus. Explains to you 2 years ago what was coming down the line. The plan is to destroy the value of our currency, to impoverish our people, to create a global economy and a global currency, and, of course, to wipe out the middle class. And that's exactly what they're in the process of doing today. That's the Financial Tsunami. Once again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. Our webpage, radioliberty.com. And then we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, the supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of William Grigg, formerly senior editor of the New American Magazine, and now, of course, working with the Welsh Society and, of course, writing a blog, writing books, doing a lot of radio. But we're honored and pleased to have him here with us this evening, as he usually is on Friday evening and usually one other afternoon during the week. William, these certainly are exciting times, aren't they?
I think exciting is the least that we can say about what's going on right now. It's invigorating and stimulating in the same sense that perhaps being on a runaway train would be invigorating and stimulating. I think previously in a conversation you and I had, Dr. Stan, I talked about being on an airplane that lost an engine and how that was something akin to the sensation I've been feeling the last week or so. Although in that case, I was more mystified as to what was going on exactly. I mean, you and I have discussed what was going on in the economy, and we have been talking for many months now about what would be happening at this point in this year, how we're now at a point where the day of reckoning has come and the impact of what's going on in the financial markets is being felt in the larger economy. Just the beginning, the foreshadowing of what's going to be felt in the larger economy, it's only going to get worse from here. And so I think that while it's exciting, and of course there's a sense of dreadful, undesirable vindication here for those of us who criticize the fiat money system and the debt system that we have been enslaved into, we're confronted with the possibility here, and it's a rather a bleak one, but in some ways an ironically hopeful one, that after we finally have a settling and reality is now absolutely irresistible, even for those who've deferred their reckoning with reality for a long, long time, that finally people will begin to address the fundamentals of the system that we've been living under and try to rebuild our society on the basis of honest and equitable free market exchange. I mean, that's not what we've had. And, of course, both the print media and the electronic media have been abuzz with opportunistic people of the leftist persuasion trying to tell us that this is a repudiation of the so-called free market fundamentalism of the Bush years. I just saw that incomparably ignorant doofus Joe Conanson on Salon.com say this morning that this is a rebuke to the so-called fundamentalist free marketeers of the Bush junta, and how what we have to have now is just an unprecedented orgy of spending by the federal government. He was chastising, wasn't Mr. Conanson, a comment, or John McCain, for a comment that he had made in a recent appearance where he had said something to the effect that government needs to be spending less money, which, of course, is completely uncharacteristic for John McCain. It's true, government has to stop spending money, but John McCain has never displayed so much as a particle of interest in austerity. But Joe Conanson said, no, exactly the opposite is the course we need to take. Government needs to start spending on everything. And I've even heard some otherwise intelligent and rational people talk about the supposed merits now of a Keynesian industrial policy for the United States as a way of getting us out of the depression that we're now sliding into. Joe Battaglia, who's a man for whom I have tremendous respect, was saying that it would be a wonderful idea to have the government start retooling our industrial capacity for the purpose of reviving our space program and having a crash course to land man on the moon again the way that happened in the 1960s, which is part of the problem that led to our bankruptcy. We were running the space program at the same time we were fighting a land war in Asia and expanding the welfare state to an unprecedented degree, which led to our de facto bankruptcy in August of 1971.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg right here at Radio Liberty. William, go right ahead.
Yeah. What happened in the 1960s is that we had, of course, the new frontier on top of the Great Society, on top of the go anywhere, pay any price, bear any burden interventionist foreign policy of the new frontier and Great Society, to where we were fighting a land war in Asia. We were involved in various concealed covert surrogate wars, brushfire wars across the world. We were building huge, probably the largest and most expensive welfare state in history at the time. And at the same time, we were involved in a crash course to land man on the moon as sort of a sidelight to the ideological struggle, as we were told, with the Soviet Union, which is actually more of a professional wrestling match in terms of what really was going on behind the scenes. But I heard, once again, somebody for whom I have immeasurable respect, Joe Battaglia, yesterday talking about the idea of reviving the industrial policy of the space program and using this as an impetus by way of federal subsidy for the education of engineers and the retooling of our industrial sector as a way of getting our country out of the depression that we're headed into. And that's pure Keynesian economics. The idea is that by government spending, we would somehow be able to avoid the general decline in prices that is part of a depression. And that's what happened, of course, beginning in 1929 under Hoover and accelerating into 1931, 1932, that was criticized by FDR during the 1932 presidential campaign. We mentioned this before. FDR ran as a relative free marketeer. He was criticizing Herbert Hoover from the right. And in the history that we are taught, this Sovietized Orwellian pseudo-history that is given to people in the public mind laundries that we call schools, Herbert Hoover is depicted as the great liquidator that he was supposedly going through and liquidating all these large, unperforming corporate and free market enterprises. But exactly the opposite was the case. He was keeping them in business. He was artificially trying to keep prices up through government intervention, which exacerbated the effects, of course, of the contraction. And then once FDR, who had campaigned on exactly the opposite premises, came to power, he gave us Hooverism cubed. He built on the foundation that had been laid by Herbert Hoover on the Keynesian assumption that government spending is the way to reagitate an economy that has been ravaged by inflation and is falling into depression. And we have otherwise sound and sensible people saying the same things now, as well as a lot of these left-wing opportunists who never leave unimproved an opportunity to try to undermine people's true understanding, reliable understanding of what free market economics is. If we had a fundamentalist free market economy right now, these large corrupt enterprises...
Hold that thought. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and William is just saying that so many people are saying today, what we need is more government spending, more government programs. He was quoting a gentleman who wants to reactivate the space program and use that program to justify training more scientists and retooling America. And, of course, this is exactly the opposite of what we need. We need to get government back to, a logical point. We need to get to a asset-backed financial system where the government cannot simply artificially expand the monetary supply and create more of the same. If we're going to rescue our economy, we've got to get back to a position where bankers or certainly the Federal Reserve or government officials can't massively expand the money supply. Do you realize they've increased the money in circulation 12-fold between 1971 and 2005? That's a little over, 34 years. And then in the last 4 years, 3 years actually, they've increased the money in circulation over $4 trillion. And then you wonder why prices have gone up, why we, of course, get the fabulously, a very, very good economy, but we're spending money that is all imaginary.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the system begins to fall apart, when it begins to contract as it invariably does, why we hear the calls not to try to get back to where we were and with a sound economy, but for more of the same. And what do we do? Why, we give the people who created the problem fabulous amounts of money to solve the problem they've created when they have no idea even what the cause of it is. So you pick up this story.
Or if they do know what the cause of it is, they're actively deceiving the public as to what the cause is. And they're imputing to free market economics what's happened as a result of government intervention. I mean, as I was saying before the break, if we had an actual free market economy based on free market fundamentalism, as Joe Conanson said in his criminally obtuse piece in Salon.com, these large, incredibly corrupt, politically connected corporate interests that are being bailed out right now, first of all, most probably wouldn't exist because they're based on perverse incentives and the type of relationship with the government that immunizes them against accountability. It's really a sense of severe moral hazard that empowers these corporations, these investment banks, and large Wall Street entities to be governed the way that they are, so they probably wouldn't exist. But if they somehow were to come into being and thrive through corruption and deceit, they would have to absorb the consequences of their own miscalculations. They would have to be liquidated. They would have to make their own arrangements with their creditors. Their corporate leaders, their shareholders, the people who were involved in the enterprise would have to deal with their mess on their own time and on their own hook. You wouldn't have a situation where the risks and penalties here would be subsidized and then socialized and put on the backs of people like you and me who had nothing to do with the conscious deceit that that inflated these entities in such a malignant way. But you're talking about what's going on with the amount of money that's been pumped or created, first of all, ex nihilo, and then pumped into the economy over the decades here. The fact that we've had $4 trillion put in the system just in the last couple of years. It's fascinating to me to take a look at what's happened this last week, where we have the largest single drop, not only in terms of outright numbers, but also in terms of percentage. An 18% drop in the Dow over the course of 1 week, the worst week during the Great Depression in 1933. If I remember correctly, you had a drop of something just north of 17%. So we are already in territory exceeding in some ways the worst elements of the Great Depression. We've yet to see the impacts on the larger economy that we saw or that we read about. I mean, you lived through some of this, Dr. Stan. The rest of us have read about it and studied it during the Great Depression. But we heard about the fact that these 401k accounts, these retirement accounts, have seen in excess of $2 trillion in virtual wealth vanish into the ether. Now, that wealth, of course, only existed hypothetically anyway. It existed in the form of electronic impulses on databases that were transcribed as numbers on pieces of paper sent out to 401k account owners. And, of course, what that means is that there are a lot of people that are going to have to defer their retirement now because they no longer have any money in their accounts, in their 401k accounts. Or they've lost most of the usable equity in their usable value in their 401ks. It's a terrible thing, and I think you're probably going to see a lot of people cashing out, taking the 10% penalty and cashing out of the 401ks, and I think that'd be a good thing to do. The other thing I thought that was remarkable was Jim Cramer's announcement on Monday, just as we were starting to see this wave, this tsunami of panic selling take place on Wall Street. Jim Cramer, of course, is the clinically deranged host of Mad Money. I call him clinically deranged. I'm not a psychologist. I'm not a psychiatrist. I think I just recognize clinical derangement when I see it. His gimmick for many, many years was that he was the febrile, unfettered bull market advocate. He was always talking about getting into the market and making money and how you really needed to be active and keep your money in the market when things got a little bit discouraging or a little bit scary. He had a breakdown on live television about a year and 4 months ago where he was screaming at the Fed for its supposed parsimony in not opening the discount window and flooding the markets with equity. He was worried about the fact that there were so many of his friends in the investment banker community who are going to be losing their jobs. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, in August of this year, after there had been some upheaval in the Dow and there had been a couple of these large bank failures, I mean the Bear Stearns failure in particular, in August of this year when he was on the Morning Joe program on, I believe it's MSNBC or CNBC, I think it's CNBC, he called the bottom on the market. He said, it's perfectly safe. We're going to have a few banks that are going to fail, but your deposits are going to be okay, your investments are going to be okay, so get back into the market. And then on Monday of this past week, he said, I want everybody to get out of the market right away. I don't care what kind of a loss you take. I don't care what it's going to do in terms of your larger investment strategy. If you're not the sort of a person who can take a really big loss, take all your money out of the Dow and stay out of it for 5 years. He was sober. He was restrained. He said, this is something I didn't want to say on television in public, but I really don't care how I come off. I don't want these people getting hurt by what's going to happen. And that, of course, was something that really left a lot of people shocked, because this is the man who is the definitive archetypal bull, Wall Street bull. And here he was saying, get out of the Dow. And, of course, this is the week that a lot of people started to do it, and that's going to keep going. But the biggest news, of course, is what's going on right now with this G7 and IMF meeting in Washington. And they've got 3 days now to wreak all kinds of mischief. And we've heard from Mr. Berlusconi from Italy, who's a rather interesting piece of work himself, that there's a possibility that we're going to see a holiday on Wall Street, that they'll have a market holiday of an unspecified period of time while new rules are written. And there was a terse and very brief statement issued by the G7 representatives. I've got a copy of it here on my desk right now. It's only a few paragraphs long, but it compensates in opacity for what it lacks in length. It's very brief, and it couples the virtue of brevity with the liability of being almost impossible to understand until you get to the very end, where it talks about how, quote, we strongly support the IMF's critical role in assisting countries affected by this turmoil. We will accelerate full implementation of the financial stability forum recommendations. We are committed to the pressing need for reform of the financial system. We will strengthen further our cooperation and work with others to accomplish this plan. That's, of course, almost indecipherable boilerplate, but there are a couple of very important points here. They make reference to this entity called the Financial Stability Forum. This is a group that was created about 10 years ago, I believe 1999. It's attached to the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland, which is this boot-shaped, it's housed in this boot-shaped edifice that some people have referred to as the boot from George Orwell's 1984, you know, the image of a boot stamping on a human face forever. The fellow who is in charge of the FSF, the Financial Stability Forum, is an individual named Mario Draghi. And he's the guy who, several months ago, submitted this 12-page series of recommendations for managing the hedge funds and the derivatives. And given the fact that I don't have the specified training in the esoteric language of international banking, a lot of what he wrote in those recommendations, quite frankly, went over my head, but I can recognize in the interlinear passages in this document the fact that they're calling for tighter international controls on banking and a collectivized banking system that would be international in nature. And, of course, now we've got a situation where, as Herr Paulson, our new economic dictator, pointed out today, the Federal Reserve has what he calls a swap line with 9 central banks, which means, of course, that the Federal Reserve is now creating, quote-unquote, money and using these swap lines as a way of bailing out these 9 national central banks throughout the world. You've got the big Federal Reserve, the Big Mama, and the 9 daughters. And the 9 daughters are like the horse leech's daughters from, I believe, the book of Ecclesiastes, or the book of Proverbs, rather, in the Old Testament. They just say, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me. And that's the way that these 9 central banks are going to be acting here.
And I think it's important for our listeners to understand that they've already been shipping. The figure I've seen is about $1.5 trillion dollars, which we don't have. They've created $1.5 trillion American dollars and shipped them to the central banks of Europe to try to stop the hemorrhaging from the banks over there. And believe me, the central banks in those countries then control the banks in their countries. And basically, the whole world financial system is collapsing as we speak today.
Yeah, they never sleep. They never sleep. They made arrangements where they literally steal what we have earned, what we have saved, and what we will earn and save into the indefinite future while we sleep, while we work, while we eat, while we try to raise our families and so forth. It's on autopilot right now, and will be until the whole system completely collapses. The thing I find interesting here is that this guy who's in charge of the FSF, the Financial Stability Forum, whose recommendations are going to provide the framework now for this globalized financial regulatory system and this globalized banking system, where they're going to create this global money system, ultimately with a new global currency. You take a look at his vita, and the very last line of it is that he joined Goldman Sachs as a partner in January 2002 and was, at the time that this was written in 2004, vice chairman and managing director of Goldman Sachs.
Hold that thought. I wonder who Henry Paulson really represents, America or Goldman Sachs?
It's almost as if you've got here a case of Goldman Sachs becoming the de facto ruling economic body of the world. Because, as I pointed out earlier, when we were talking about the bailout of AIG, this huge, very highly connected insider insurance and financial firm, that when they bailed out AIG, the Federal Reserve created what was almost $80 billion out of nothing. And the main counterparty now, the benefits from this, is Goldman Sachs. There was one CEO present at the meeting where Herr Paulson was working out the arrangement to bail out AIG. And the bank that was chosen to do this was Goldman Sachs, because there was only one CEO present in the negotiations, and it was the current CEO of Goldman Sachs. Mr. Paulson himself is the former CEO of Goldman Sachs. Here we have the vice chairman of Goldman Sachs, the former vice chairman, Mario Draghi, heading the FSF, the Financial Stability Forum at the Bank of International Settlements in Basel. And he's the guy working out the blueprint now for the new global regulatory apparatus that's going to be part of this globalized financial system. And as you pointed out, Dr. Stan, the Federal Reserve is creating hundreds of billions, over $1 trillion, that is pumping into these central banks abroad in order to try to unlock the credit markets, supposedly. And that's something, of course, that it's doing of its own volition. The Congress has no say in this. Of course, those of us who are merely part of the public at large have nothing to say about this as well. There's a wonderful analyst of markets by the name of Ed Bugos. He works at Agora Financial, and he points out the following. I quote, "The news that should be driving gold prices to the moon is that the Federal Reserve has just expanded its balance sheet more in 1 month than it has in almost all of its first 86 years of existence." That is flatly astonishing to me. In 1 month, it's almost doubled the balance sheet that it had created over the course of over 8 decades. So we're at a point now where everything has gone hyperbolic in terms of the money supply. You've got the G7 and the IMF meeting in Washington right now to decide what they're going to do in terms of creating this new global architecture for the banking system. You've got the very real possibility that next week, or perhaps the week after that, sometime, we're going to have a market holiday. It seems to me almost impossible to believe that we will not have, if we give the double negative, a banking holiday at some point as these new regulatory measures come online and the new architecture in terms of the banking system is worked out. And with that, of course, we find the very real possibility that you're going to have a situation where, as a number of people have discovered elsewhere, overseas primarily, people who have their money in the banks are not going to have access to their funds. They won't be able to access their money through ATMs. They're not going to be able to go to a bank to make withdrawals because the banks are going to be closed. I don't know what will happen with the short-term credit market, the very immediate-term credit market that is the lifeblood of commercial activity. You really can't operate a supply system of the sort that we have in this country that keeps the grocery shelves stocked with food and the tanks stocked with gasoline at your local convenience stores if you do not have access to short-term commercial credit. That's something the Federal Reserve now has decided is within its purview. But the thing is, there's a very real possibility, as a number of analysts I read this morning scared the living daylights out of me, to be blunt about it.
Hold that thought. We're going to be back here in just a moment with William Craig. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William is talking about what's going to happen, especially if we begin to see the breakdown of the system. We have a bank holiday, and they're actually talking articles up there on the web, on the Internet, of a bank holiday for a few days or maybe for a few weeks, and suddenly no credit available. And what will happen to our economy, if suddenly, even if for just a few days, credit is cut off? Because, you see, most of our major corporations live on credit. I mean, certainly when industrial producers want to produce products, they borrow money and then they hire workers and they bring in the products and then they turn out the products and pay off the temporary loans and start all over again. Our farmers have to borrow money to get the money for the seed and the fertilizers and then they put it in the ground, plant the crops, and then when the money is paid to them at the end of the growing season, why they pay back their loans. But what would happen if just temporarily there was no credit. And you pick up the story there, William, because this is something that people do not understand. Our whole economy runs on credit. And, of course, rather than people having money and paying for what they need and what they want to produce, suddenly it's all done with borrowed money. And since it's really the money doesn't exist because it's all simply based upon debt, why, of course, we have an impossible situation. And when that begins to crumble, why it keeps right on crumbling, which is what's happening now. So
yeah,
go right ahead with that.
There really is nothing that is holding the system up apart from, this is sort of an awkward way of phrasing it, apart from inertia. It's interesting, Mr. Bush this morning, who has been in so many ways the architect of our terminal decline, or at least has been the figurehead for the people who are the architects of our terminal decline. Mr. Bush is not the evil genius behind these developments. He's simply the useful idiot who's been put out front of the oligarchy that is responsible for a lot of these developments. But he said that basically the whole thing behind our travails this last week or two is a lack of confidence in the markets. So he's basically talking about the virtue of magical thinking. He's resorting to the clap for Tinkerbell approach to economic prosperity, which, of course, is not true. It's not confident, a lack of confidence in the sense that if we really believed in it, we could somehow make these infirm institutions work. It's a lack of confidence begotten by an understanding that there is nothing behind most of these institutions. There's nothing behind our currency. There is no value behind these debt instruments that are being bought up now with taxpayer funds in the investment markets. And there's no confidence on the part of creditors that when they lend money, they're going to get it back, which is why the LIBOR rate has skyrocketed. And of course, the London Interbank Offered rate, that's really what caused the credit crunch. And that reflects the fact that people understand that there's no way they're going to collect on a lot of these debts. And so when you have people who are in the business in short-term financing, they are in the business of taking out short-term loans and paying them off assiduously. People like that cannot get credit. That's when the economic system starts to break down. That's what we have to look out for. And that, I think, is not really what the people who are running the system right now are concerned about, because they're taken care of. If we do have a real sudden seizure, if suddenly the gears of that mechanism seize up and we can't get short-term credit in the hands of people who pay it back faithfully, then those of us who are mere peons, the helots, the hoi polloi, you know, the common mundanes, the run-of-the-mill population, we're going to get it in the back, because that's the fuel that propels our just-in-time service economy here. We have a just-in-time delivery system for our grocery stores and a just-in-time delivery system for our convenience stores. We get food and fuel, food and gasoline, on the basis of getting it there pretty much within a hair's breadth in chronological terms of it running out. And so what's going to happen is you're going to have shortages. We've already had shortages for other reasons in the southeastern part of the United States, shortages of fuel, having to do, of course, with the dislocations associated with the hurricane season. But we're likely to see severe dislocations of the supply line for gasoline and for the grocery stores, for the national grocery stores in particular, if that element of the credit market suddenly seizes up, as it probably will over the next couple of weeks. And what that means is that you'll suddenly end up with a shortage and runs on the available supplies, and if it lasts for longer than a couple of weeks, you're going to see riots. And with riots, of course, will most likely come riot control. And that's the other element of this equation that really has to be looked into very carefully.
And I think that we all remember just in this last week or so, we heard about a brigade, a battle-hardened brigade from Iraq that had been brought back and assigned to the Office of Homeland Security, Northern Command, but of course the Office of Homeland Security, in case of a civil unrest. Ladies and gentlemen, they knew exactly what was going to happen. Nothing is happening by chance. This is all carefully designed. And you're supposed to think these people are bumbling idiots? Ladies and gentlemen, not bumbling idiots. They're diabolical, but they're not idiots. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest, of course, is William Grigg, and we were simply talking about the fact that they, in October of 2006, they repealed the Posse Comitatus Act, so now they can use the military, the American military against American citizens, which has not been allowed going back to 1870. We're talking about, what, almost 140 years or more. And so why would they certainly repeal the Posse Comitatus Act in October of 2006? Because they knew exactly where we were headed. They're following a timetable, but they're not going to tell us what's going to happen next. We're just going to have to wait and be surprised. Pick up the story there, William.
They know what they're doing, and of course, for the rest of us, it's like Ferris Bueller, it's like Forrest Gump's box of chocolates. You never know what you're going to get. Well, we can make some educated guesses as to what lurks within that confection. First of all, as you point out, a couple of years ago, there was a revolution in legal affairs that occurred in this country. The Military Commissions Act effectually did away with habeas corpus, the foundational due process guarantee. The government under habeas corpus cannot simply lock you up. The government has to justify, within a very limited time frame, in a proceeding before an independent judge, its act of detaining you by formally charging with a crime, or it has to release you. Under the MCA, which also made provisions for the creation of a judicial body that answers to the president, not an Article III court under congressional jurisdiction or under the appellate scrutiny of the Supreme Court, it answers to the president. It created this independent judicial body for the purpose of trying enemy combatants who would be terrorists, as well as other people who are not necessarily terrorists. That's one of the really potently mischievous elements of this, is the fact that an enemy combatant could be somebody who simply designated an enemy of the state by the president. And, of course, you also have the ratification and immunity of granted to those who practice torture under presidential authority. But the most important element, I think, is the derogation from the pristine standard of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus is indispensable. Without that, basically, we don't have any rights that the government has to respect. And the other element of what happened in October 2006 was this amendment to the Insurrection Act. There was an effort earlier this year by Patrick Leahy to go back and restore the Posse Comitatus protections. Posse Comitatus, of course, refers to the law passed in 1878 that was enacted subsequent to the Reconstruction, the military occupation of the conquered and reassimilated southern states.
Hold that thought, William. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, William was talking about the Military Commission Act passed in October of 2006 that did away with the right of habeas corpus for anybody who was accused of being a terrorist. And then, of course, at the same time, why they did away with the Posse Comitatus Act, and even Liberal Senator Patrick Leahy had basically said, this, of course, is the blueprint for a police state. And apparently, earlier this year, far-left Senator Patrick Leahy, not one of our so-called conservative Republican patriots, but Liberal Senator Patrick Leahy tried to get the Posse Comitatus Act reinstituted so they could not use American troops against American citizens. And what happened?
Well, what happened, of course, is the Bush administration, as has been its pattern, said, well, that's very interesting, and, of course, that has been enacted in law. It was the Patrick Leahy measure was attached to an appropriations bill that was signed into law by the president, but once again had a signing statement issued by George W. Bush that reserved to the president the prerogative of deciding whether or not to obey that element of the law that he had just signed. And that's been a habit at which Mr. Bush has become notorious, has been the practice of pending signing statements to pieces of legislation by way of providing an out to a president if he should decide that the text of the law interferes with his ambitions. The purpose of a signing statement historically was to give instruction to the executive branch personnel as to how to carry out the terms of the law that had just been enacted. That was the purpose of signing statements, hundreds of which have been issued throughout history. But you have, in the presidency of George W. Bush, I think a greater number of signing statements than the cumulative number of his 42 predecessors. and now you've got in George W. Bush somebody who uses signing statements for the purpose of creating an exemption for the president. Should he decide that he doesn't want to be bound by the law, he can just invoke the text of his own signing statement. One was attached to this provision that Patrick Leahy had gotten passed with respect to posse comitatus, and the fact that we now have a brigade, a Homeland Security brigade, under the direction of the Northern Command, which covers the continental United States, training in and preparing for riot control, illustrates the fact that posse comitatus really isn't going to impede the ambitions of the White House should it consider it necessary to use the military domestically to deal with the social turmoil that's likely to ensue as this economic crisis deepens and strengthens. And so I talked about the fact that 2 years ago we had this revolution in legal affairs during October. We're literally seeing an October revolution here in the United States in what we could almost call the Soviet sense of the expression. You don't have Lenin and a small clique storming the Winter Palace and then imposing a dictatorship on a country spanning 11 time zones. Nothing quite that traumatic in that respect. But what's going on with respect to the banking system and the financial system and our whole monetary system is just as dramatic, if not more so. You actually have here, I think, the consummation of a revolution that began in 1913 when we saw the creation of the Federal Reserve, which was a national central bank akin to that described in the fifth plank of the Communist Revolution. But the Communist Revolution also talks about the centralization of credit in the hands of that bank and in the hands of a central government. And that's what we're seeing right now when Mr. Paulson is working side by side with Comrade Bernanke, the chief commissar of the Federal Reserve, the Lenin of our new revolution. They've made it clear that they consider it to be within their proper authority to use as much money as they see fit to create in any way that they see fit. They can buy up any asset. They can take ownership now of the banking system. They're talking now about buying up and taking ownership interests in commercial banks. There's a good possibility we're going to end up perhaps with four main banks, and eventually they'd be consolidated, I believe, to one bank with local branches here nationally as part of a system that would be internationally administered. This is all something that is being created right now, and is being created under the aegis of Herr Paulson, using his plenary authority to reshape our entire economy as he sees fit. Congress alienated to this executive branch official its power to control the public purse. That's what really happened a week ago. $700 billion, yes, that was a huge and profound derogation from the wealth of the American public. And, of course, it was almost all spent before the ink was dry on the bill, this Economic Enabling Act that was passed on Friday a week ago. But that sum is relatively inconsequential when you're talking about the ability of the Federal Reserve to conjure out of thin air literally trillions of what it's pleased to call dollars in order to prop up this banking system. The real revolution that was contained in that measure last week, the so-called Economic Stabilization Act, it's amazing how the worst bills always have the most anodyne names. The so-called Economic Stabilization Act actually created a literal economic dictatorship here. And as I've said before, it's sort of built around a triumvirate now, the system we have. Congress really doesn't have any role in this. Congress no longer controls the public purse. Henry Paulson now controls any assets and any amount that he sees fit, working in collaboration with the Fed chairman in order to control as much of the economy as they see necessary in order to stabilize that economy.
And I think it's important for our listeners to understand that Mr. Henry Paulson does not represent the interests of the United States.
No.
He represents the interests of Goldman Sachs and the international financiers. And the legislation, he said, oh, this is for Main Street. This isn't for Wall Street. He got it wrong. Or he knew exactly who it was for. It was to bail out his friends on Wall Street. This is not going to help the little guy. This is just the down payment on the transfer of wealth from the middle class to the powerful. And of course, the middle class will be wiped out. Our population will be impoverished. And there will be a small, wealthy ruling class, of course, who will control and purchase the support of the various politicians as they did just a week ago today. when they put in $150 billion of additional pork and goodies for the 20 congressmen who betrayed their constituents and voted. And 4 days after they repudiated this idea, they voted in favor of it, and it became the law of the land. It was signed that very day. Isn't that amazing? Passed, certainly, it was introduced on Monday and rejected. It was introduced in the Senate on Wednesday and passed. It was then passed by the House of Representatives on Friday, and the President of the United States signed that legislation the very same day and hurriedly put it into action. Of course, we're told that the market was going to collapse if they didn't do it. And what happened?
They passed
the legislation, and we've seen the greatest collapse of the stock market in our nation's history. I wonder what would happen if they hadn't passed it.
Well, what we get is the worst of both worlds. I mean, people always talk in terms that I define as the fallacy of lesser evilism. We have to choose the lesser evil. Well, we never choose the lesser evil. When we choose an evil, we choose the greater evil, because the greater evil is that which is actually done, not that which is merely hypothesized. In this case, we got the worst of both worlds. We were told the stock market would collapse in the event they did not pass this measure, alienating to an economic dictator control over the public purse. Now we end up with that dictator, plus a market collapse that is still ongoing, the worst market collapse in the history of the world. It is measurably worse than the worst market collapse that took place during the Great Depression. So we got both ends of that deal. And the other element of this that we have to discuss is what Congressman Brad Sherman from California, Democratic member of Congress, pointed out in his dramatic floor speech last Friday, which was that in addition to threats of market collapse, members of Congress who proved to be unreceptive to the idea of passing this economic dictatorship plan were told that if they did not do so, there would be martial law on the streets of the United States. Of course, what that means, from where I'm sitting, is that this is a form of blackmail, a form of terrorism by way of extortion. These people were being threatened with something that nobody wanted to see, apparently, on the part of those who were opposed to this bill. But we got the market collapse anyway. I think what we're going to get is martial law anyway as well. Because
if I could suggest to our listeners, if you have access to a computer, go up and simple Google in YouTube, YouTube, and then, of course, Brad Sherman. Or if you can't do that, why go to our website, RadioLiberty.com, and go to the section on other videos, and you'll find a link to this video, this YouTube video, and you'll hear Congressman Sherman talking about the fact that they were warned, the congressmen were warned, there'd be troops on the streets and there would be an economic collapse last Monday. Well, we didn't get the troops on the streets, but we sure got the economic collapse, despite the fact that they admitted the congressmen voted for it. But certainly, if Brad Sherman was my congressman, I would vote for him, even though he is a Democrat.
Yeah.
In fact, I think what we need to do is vote every Republican and every Democrat who voted for this betrayal out of office because they're not fit for public service.
Yeah, there's no way that you could vote for somebody who would vote for this. There's no way you can reward that kind of perfidy by voting to put those people back in office. The only leverage we had over those people was the threat of unemployment. And that's why so many of these people, as was recounted by a number of anonymous congressmen who talked to Roll Call, that is, of course, the newspaper of Capitol Hill, during this controversy, a number of them said, well, I want to vote for this measure, but what's happening is that there are these furtive conversations going on in the halls of the House where people would say, this really needs to be passed, and I really think we should pass it, but I can't. I'm in a tight race for re-election. Would you vote for it instead? And what happened is that there were a number of instances where people simply refused to. They simply understood that if they did so, they would probably lose re-election. And what I'm thinking right now is that in most cases, you're going to have the power of incumbency here put to a severe test, the likes of which we've not seen for a long, long time. There was something of a rebellion in 1994 when a number of people were disgusted with a number of things that had passed during the last year that the Democrats controlled Congress. Which was, I think, the second year of the Clinton administration. A lot of it was a backlash to gun confiscation laws. A lot of it was a backlash against the attempt to socialize the health care system under the aegis of what was called Hillary Care. And so you had something of a backlash against incumbents back then, but you had nothing like this where you had 90 to 95 or higher percentage majorities opposed to this bailout.
You had congressmen saying that one congressman from Texas said, well, the mail I'm getting, the faxes, the emails, the phone calls are running 50-50. 50% say no, the other 50% say hell no. You know, you had almost public unanimity rejecting this, and yet over the course of 4 days, they pivoted, large measure because of the bribes, but also through the blackmail. And they endorsed something which is literally going to impoverish, it's going to impecuniate the entire middle class of this country. And I think that you have to punish these people through the appropriate constitutional means of voting them out of office, irrespective of their party labels. And, of course, the thing is that leaves people without somebody to vote for in the presidential election either, because you had George W. Bush flanked by Obama and McCain, all three of them putting up a common front in favor of this bailout. In the case of Obama, here's somebody whose miraculous fundraising has been driven by Wall Street, many of these people who are involved in precisely the type of economic activity that has led to the credit meltdown. He was number two on the list of people who received donations from those attached to Fannie Mae. 11 of his top 20 donors are attached to most of the Wall Street investment banks that have either been rescued or backstopped or gone out of business. I mean, he was very close to Lehman Brothers, for instance, but he's also been close to Citigroup and Goldman Sachs and all these other, most of the bundlers, the people who put together large tranches of donations for Obama's campaign, come out of that milieu, out of the Wall Street milieu. And he gave a speech, did Mr. Obama. He's somebody who, of course, is renowned for his supposed eloquence, which is more superficial glibness than anything else. He gave a speech talking about how indecorous this appeared to be, rewarding people for running their businesses into the ground and destroying the financial markets by doing so. He gave a couple of nods in the direction of condemning the moral hazard and the perverse incentives that are involved in subsidizing the risks and socializing the losses. And then he said, no, this is something we have to do anyway. This is a bad deal, but when I am president, you know, when my munificent self is installed as the next dear leader of this country, then I'll go through and, you know, I guess on the basis of his personality, his insight, and his divine nature, he's going to transmute this bad deal into something good. McCain, of course, is somebody bereft of eloquence, but he stolidly endorsed this as well. So you've got the two candidates from the two branches of the establishment party deeply implicated in this grand act of larceny, not only of $700 billion and counting dollars pilfered from the wealth of the American public and lavished on the corporate whores of Wall Street, but also in the alienation, this unacknowledged constitutional revolution of taking the power of the purse out of the hands of Congress and putting it in the hands of Goldman Sachs. And so really, there's nobody to vote for there at the top of the bill either, and I think that helps explain why this particular election cycle you really don't have, apart from some people who are cultishly devoted to Obama and the Republican elements who are cultishly opposed to him, you don't really have any passion, any intensity here of attachment to any of the candidates, because I think there is a realization on the part of the electorate at long last that there's no difference here, that these are fungible commodities, these two candidates. They're completely interchangeable, and that they're in the hire, they're completely in the thrall of the people who are now wrecking our economy and who visited this catastrophe on us. But it is important, whatever else you do, that you punish those. If, for instance, you live in a congressional district where your congressman voted for this monstrosity, the eastern section of the state of Idaho is in that category. Mike Simpson, the congressman supposedly representing that part of the state, voted both times for this bailout measure. And I dearly hope that the voters in the eastern half of my home state will visit upon him the appropriate consequence by offering him an opportunity to explore new employment in the private sector. But if you live in a district where your congressman voted for this thing, you need to vote him out. I mean, that's the least that has to happen here.
I agree with you totally, and I think, of course, the only way it's going to happen is for people to start talking about it. It's interesting because the McCain-Feingold bill, that private organizations, you know, that are publicly tax-supported cannot actually let people know how the congressman votes within 60 days. That's,
yep.
One of the greatest abridgments of freedom of speech. We can thank John McCain for it. It was supposedly, yep, of course, to prevent, you know, people from getting illicit campaign contributions. They're still going to get the campaign contributions, but what they've really done is to silence opposition people who wanted to let the public know how the congressman voted. One of the worst pieces of legislation ever conceived of, and we can thank John McCain.
Yes, that's exactly right. It's the Incumbency Protection Act, and I mentioned a few minutes ago the fact that we're dealing here with a literal October Revolution of a Soviet Bolshevik variety. There's a remarkable piece out of from the Telegraph of London by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who's a very canny observer as to what's going on, but hopelessly Keynesian in his outlook, where he talks about the fact that, quote, what Washington has done, what Washington has done to prevent the collapse of the U.S. economy, it has taken over the entire credit system, after all, surpassing Roosevelt's New Deal. The U.S. has guaranteed the $3.5 trillion money market funds. It has nationalized the 5.3 trillion pillars of the mortgage market, Fannie and Freddie.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with William Grigg. William, we're almost out of time. I do want you to get out your website and let people know how they can get your material.
Okay, I'll do that. Very quickly, I want to extract one more thing here from whatever.
Go ahead.
The U.S. government has become a bank. Yes, this is U.S. socialism. What is the alternative? Concludes Ambrose Evans Pritchard. Well, the alternative, of course, is free market economics, which has been tried now. We've put that in abeyance now for over 90 years, and that, of course, is the alternative. It'd be painful, but we would have the advantage of cleaning up the mess. To get to my blog site, which is called Pro Libertate, the easiest way to do it is to go to willgrigg.com. That's sort of a holding company website, if you will, for a lot of the things I'm involved in. If you go to willgrigg.com, look in the upper right-hand corner. There's a list of links, outside links. The top one goes to Pro Libertate. That's the blog that I publish between 3 and 5 times a week as opportunity presents itself. I'm a little bit laggard this week. The last essay I published was published brand new on Wednesday morning. I started work on it on Tuesday, but this last week I've been doing what I can to provide for my family in terms of protecting us against the ravages that are about to be inflicted upon our country. And that means that I've been out getting emergency provisions. I've been out purchasing where I can commodity money, gold and silver. I've been looking into some emergency supplies, some ready-to-eat food. I'm pricing water purifiers. I'm trying to liaise with some friends to multiply and leverage our efforts by pooling our resources to supply each other's needs in these terrible times we live in. These are things that we have to attend to right now. Yeah, the political dimension of this is important, but we've gone primal here. There's something more fundamental than politics that's implicated in this crisis. Look to the security of your family and your loved ones first. Yes, get out and vote in November. Punish the people responsible for inflicting this catastrophe on our nation. That's an important thing. But more importantly, get liquid right now. Have some ready cash on hand, preferably enough to meet a month's needs, if not more. Be prepared against the possibility of having a sudden cutoff of access to food and fuel. That's something that may happen if the short-term credit market seize up, which is a legitimate possibility. In the event of a bank holiday, you're not going to have access to your ATM. You won't be able to use credit cards or debit cards. That's why you need enough cash to get by for perhaps 4 to 6 weeks. And it's a good idea, once again, to have some commodity money, gold and silver, particularly pre-1964 U.S. coins, 90% silver or so-called junk silver, that can trade at multiple times face value, usually between 11 to 15 times face value. Because it's coin money, it's accepted more readily than bullion in the event of emergency. Make sure that you have a pantry stocked with foods that are very easy to prepare, things that can be eaten right out of the can if necessary.
And William, we're out of time. God bless. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we do hope, of course, you've enjoyed our conversation with William Grigg. He was just talking about the things that people should be doing now, how they should be laying in food supplies, how they should be getting in some sort of water purifier. He talked about how people should be laying in certainly health supplies, and certainly if you'd like information on any of these items, why, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. Do not put this off. I mean, because as we are moving into some very uncharted waters, you do need to have dehydrated food or long-term storage food on hand. You do need to have a water purifier. You do need all sorts of medical supplies, and I'm talking about health products, vitamins, minerals, antibiotic, which of course is a combination of herbs, which will help you fight off influenza or some other illness. And of course, there's no antibiotics that are going to help you with the influenza or other viral diseases that might be coming, but you need to have your immune system working fine. Of course, you need substantial doses of vitamin D to go along with the antibiotic. If you'd like to know more, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. I have a feeling of urgency, as I tell you. We've been talking to our listeners for a long period of time. Hopefully, many of them, well, we know that many of them have taken our advice and are prepared, but the vast majority of the people are simply sitting back and saying, it could never happen here. It could never happen here. Well, I would tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it is in the process of happening, and what the future holds, I don't know. For we're entering into very uncertain times. And that, of course, brings us to the discussion of the all-day conference we're going to be having here in the Monterey Bay area on the 26th of October at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course. And God willing, why, we're going to have a great turnout. We're not completely sold out yet, but we're getting there. And you're going to need a reservation. We're going to be serving lunch. And, of course, we're bringing in some great speakers. We're going to have Dr. Russell Blaylock talking on medical issues. We're going to have Joanna Michelson talking about her experience in the supernatural when she was a medium and the miracles she saw, but miracles that came from the dark side. And then, of course, we're going to have Patrick Wood talking about the financial crisis that we're facing. And we're talking a little about, well, just a little over 2 weeks and 1 day from now. If we're going to be out, it's on a Sunday, the October 26th. So if you can come, why, bring a friend. Our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. I'm sure you'll have a good time and you'll find it was well worthwhile. I certainly enjoy these programs every single year when we've had them. We've had them for 5 or 6 years now, and I think everybody's enjoyed themselves. Everybody's learned a great deal. So then, of course, if you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. You need to get the talk that goes with it. You need to get the tape that goes with it and circulate it and get it to other people's hands. And you have our permission to copy and duplicate anything that we produce as long as you're not making money on it. We have, of course, 4 tape sets on the Bilderbergers or 4 CD sets on the Bilderbergers. We have 4 tape sets on the Bohemian Grove and the Satanic Activities. We have a great 4 tape set on the Wisdom of Malachi Martin. We have our talk on the Forbidden Secret, because there is a secret that's been around for 5,000 years. And those who know the secret, many of them are some of the richest men in the world today. And of course, they have great power and great fame, but we want you to know the secret's there. But we do not want you to access it, because it could cost you your eternal soul. But you must understand that there are secret societies, and this secret has been passed down through these secret societies, the priests and the prophets and certainly the shamans and the witch doctors for 5,000 years. That's the Forbidden Secret with the syllabus. Our talk on the planned police state and the syllabus. You need to have the information at your fingertips so you can tell others. And I will tell you that they're going to start listening to you like never before. They'll listen now because they realize something.